you know, the powerful agriculture interests, to get those done. I wonder what keeps you so passionate and motivated about this issue when it's such a hard-won battle?
Well, Michelle, thank you. It's a really important question, because sticking with this, like if people are involved in animal protection and not feeling burned out or overwhelmed or feeling like they're tilting at windmills, is so important. I mean, when people join this cause, it's really important to stay. And I think for me, you know, number one, I just have a burning passion for animals. I recognize that animals have lives that matter to them. They care about their own lives and their well-being just as much as we care about ours. And they have the same instincts to survive that we do. I know that they're conscious. I know that they're sentient. And I also, you know that we human beings are so smart. We can live our lives. We can meet all of our needs, whether it's food or research or clothing, without victimizing animals. You know, that may have been different, you know, 200 years ago or even 100 years ago, or certainly, you know, 2000 years ago, but now is what we're talking about. And I believe that we humans have a responsibility. You know, we hear the term animal rights. You know, for me, it's less about animal rights. It's more about human responsibility. It's about how do we use our incredible intelligence? How do we use our power? And how we act toward them is a measure of our personal and collective and societal character. And we already have anti-cruelty norms in our society. States began to pass laws against animal cruelty in the first half of the 19th century, 170 years ago. All I want to do is logically apply anti-cruelty principles to the broad array of settings in which animals live. And whether it's factory farms, or whether it's the fur trade, or whether it's trophy hunting, or leg hole traps, or elephants and other wild animals in circuses, I just think we can do better. And one of the things that keeps me going, in addition to those core values, is that we're making progress. I am enlivened and I am inspired by the progress we're making. You know, when Ringling Brothers in 2016, you know, ended its live animal acts, when Giorgio Armani and hundreds of other major clothing sellers said, we're going to stop using fur, when we passed the FDA Modernization Act to eliminate an animal testing mandate, you know, that is so empowering. When we passed 5 of 5 ballot measures to give animals raised for food more space against the weight of all of these agribusiness companies that fought us every step of the way, we had landslide victories in every one of them. All of that gives me strength. And I really want to remind all of you listening who care about animals, you are not alone. And really, one of the important things for you to do is to be part of a larger community of people who care and who are taking strategic action to address these issues. And I really want to do my best. I've been fortunate to hold positions with major animal welfare organizations, including Animal Wellness Action, the center. I want to use your time effectively, and I want to use your voice so that you are empowered to drive change. I've seen incredible change. I started an animal advocacy group when I was a college student, when I was 19, and we were just on the margins. People wouldn't listen to us. Now we're a mainstream, powerful force. We're going to defeat the EATS Act. We're going to pass this new legislation on animal flight, and we're going to pass a ban on horse slaughter. We're going to end greyhound racing just in this Congress. So that's really, Michelle, what motivates me, is that we're making progress. We're not standing in place. But occasionally we have to fight defensive battles. That's what a movement is involved. You have offense and defense. You know, the opponents, you know, try to attack you, and you have to defend yourself. And that's what we're doing with the EATS Act.
You've been listening to Voices for the Animals, and we've been talking with Wayne Pacelli, president of Center for a Humane Economy and Animal Wellness Action. If you'd like to get involved in the tremendous work that they are doing, you can find them at animalwellnessaction.org. You can also find those links, as well as more information on the EATS Act and how to reach out to your federal congresspeople, at the Voices for the Animals show page at kabu.fm. And that'll do it for this month's edition of Voices for the Animals. I'm Michelle Coppola. Until next time, please be kind to animals, to others, and most of all to yourself.
Hi, this is Walt Perezader with the Group Chicago, and you're listening to KBOO FM.
Good morning, everybody. This is DK Home, and welcome to Film at 11, KBOO's weekly movie review program. I've got Jeff, Britta, and Matthew online to discuss various movies, and I'll be talking at the end of the show about one of the new BFI books. First,
in questa terra oscura, Cristo non è disceso. Cristo si è fermato a Ebori.
When Francesco Rosi's film Christ Stopped at Eboli was released in the United States in 1979, it was greeted with some disappointment and skepticism. Andrew Saris in the Village Voice criticized it for various leaps and errors and dropped storylines. But there was a reason for that. Christ Stopped at Eboli was made for Italian television, and what we saw here was a two-hour version of a four-hour episodic story based on Carlo Levi's autobiographical novel in the post-war era. The events that happened to the main character in the book also happened to Carlo Levi, in which he was exiled from Rome to the very bottom of the country, an extremely rural, isolated, and backwards section of Italy, which has often been looked down upon by the Northerners. The character is played by Gian Maria Volonté, who often collaborated with Francesco Rosi on various political movies. But in this case, he is not an action or a doer. He is an observer. And so he brings his beautiful observant eyes to what life is like within the small town, which he grows to respect and appreciate. And when he's finally freed from exile, strives to help rectify some of the political elements that are keeping them under. Christ Stopped at Eboli is now released on the Criterion Collection. It's spine number 1043. It's 220 minutes long, and it is in the 1331 format, which is for television. It's a new 2K restoration, and it features a bunch of really good extras. There's a new interview with translator and author Michael F. Moore, who discusses what it was like to create the subtitles for a movie where they are speaking a dialect that can be extremely hard to follow for even Italian speakers. There's a documentary from 1978 on Italian political cinema featuring director Rossi and actor Gian Maria Volonté shot on the set of the movie. There's also part of a 1974 documentary featuring Rossi and author Carlo Levi, who are having a bit of a love fest. And then there's an excerpt from Marco Spagnoli's 2014 documentary, Unico, in which Rossi discusses working with Volonté. There's a trailer that's negligible. It's for the Rialto Pictures release. And, of course, that has new subtitles by Moore. In the booklet, there was an essay by Alexander Steele, who is an expert on Italian culture and politics, and a statement from the director. Criterion is known for its redesigned covers, and this one is by Katya Mezhiboskaya, and it's pretty neat. It's a good movie. It's gripping. It has a great cast. And interesting things happen. You don't really know what's going to happen next. But it also meets the events at the intersection of the political and the personal in a way that Rossi is known for. That's Christ Stopped at Eboli, new on the Criterion label and available in Blu-ray. And now we're going to hear from Britta on a new movie based on the life of Robert Michael Pyle, the great lepidopterologist. And I'll let her explain what that means.
Usually, I try to avoid talking about films I can't recommend. Why waste time complaining, especially now, when we desperately need good news and there are so many good things to see? But I'm reversing myself a bit with today's film because while the film is disappointing, the subject merits discussion in the sense of this is something of a missed opportunity. The film is called Dark Divide, directed and written by Tom Putnam, currently streaming at the Hollywood and Kiggins theaters in the Portland area. It is ostensibly about the writer, naturalist, lepidopterist, and yes, Bigfoot theorizer, Robert Michael Pyle, and about the long hike that he undertook in the early 90s, traveling through the Gifford Pinchot National Forest and ending at the Columbia Gorge, over 100 miles of walking. In the film, Pyle, played by actor David Cross, explains a bit incoherently that he's decided to take on this adventure because he wants to catalog butterflies in order to further conservation efforts. Something like this. My feeling is that the director did in fact wish to make a film that honored Pyle, his wife, his mission, and the complicated reality of our beautiful and at points contested Northwest terrain. And I wondered whether he was tempted by certain story parallels to make a film similar to the popular Wild. My foreboding when I saw This Really Happened in 1995 scroll across the screen at the film's beginning turned to dismay as I witnessed the nearly two-hour-long series of sometimes literal pitfalls endured by the actor as he struggles to represent the real Pyle making his way through the forest. It's painful to watch. Pyle topples over the edge of a cliff, falls off a log into a turbulent creek, backpack and all, loses his way in a lava tunnel wearing only a pair of underpants, gets shot at by a young Native American who thinks he might be a bear, is punched in the gut by an angry logger, becomes violently ill after foraging berries, and slides through bear feces, dirtying his pants. In the penultimate shot, Pyle, finally back in his car, rolls down his window in the dark and coos into the night. A melancholy hoot answers him. He tries again. This time, inexplicably, a projectile hurling out of nowhere smashes his back window. If you think this is simply the filmmaker trying to impress on us the perils of traipsing through indifferent nature or facing benighted anti-conservationists, no, it's not just that. Pyle is portrayed as a bright-eyed, bumbling, and mostly genial egghead, slyly ridiculed by his colleagues for procrastinating on this project, blurting out the reason for his journey to an unreceptive crowd, misguidedly donning brand new boots after he climbs out of his car at the starting point, unaware of bear repelling strategies, unfamiliar with foraging techniques, prone to whimpering and whinging once he gets himself into serious trouble. The worst such episode is the lava tunnel, where Pyle, for no apparent reason, goes further and further into the twisty blackness as a thunderstorm threatens outside, in, as I've said, his underwear. Most unpleasantly, he boasts about the Guggenheim grant that has allowed him to take this trip at least four times. Thus, what we seem to have here is an anti-academic, anti-conservationist, anti-forest service, too long to explain, anti-lepidopterist. You will never feel kindly about lepidopterists if your only encounter with them is to see Pyle hunting butterflies in, need I mention this, his underwear, and really anti-anyone who is crazy enough to go out into nature for more than a day hike film. And that isn't all. Interspersed with all of this suffering is even more. Pyle's wife, the botanical artist and mushroom hunter Taya Linnea Pyle, is dying of cancer. The early part of the film intercuts scenes of the couple dealing with her illness with the beginnings of Pyle's journey. Throughout the film, we are fairly certain, although it is never spelled out, that Taya has in fact died before he sets out, Pyle agonizes about his loss. And in a truly bizarre intercut sequence as Pyle finally breaches the hillside forest to view the magnificent Columbia River, we see a deathly pale and distraught Taya driving her car at manic speed up what looks to be a logging road. The end credits tell us that a butterfly species Pyle found along his hike has been named to honor his wife. Now, if this film were entirely fictional, I could countenance it, though not enjoy it, as a straight-to-streaming dramedy. But the film is based on a real journey and a real person, and it does neither justice. And that's my final word on this film. I was initially intrigued by Dark Divide because I dimly remembered hearing people talk about Pyle's writing almost reverently when I worked in a bookstore many years ago. So I got copies of the book upon which this film is somewhat based, Where Bigfoot Walks, Crossing the Dark Divide, published in 1995. And also perhaps his most well-known book, Wintergreen, Brambles in a Ravaged Land, first published in 1986. First of all, Pyle is a wonderful companion along his Gifford Pinchot hike and his rambles in the Willapa Hills of Winter Green. Someone intimately, intellectually, and emotionally tied to our Pacific Northwest maritime ecologies and landscapes. In Wintergreen, he laments the lack of synonyms for the different kinds of rain and green that we experience here. In Where Bigfoot Walks, referred to from now on as Bigfoot, Pyle tells us why he went on his journey in this manner. I've been looking into Bigfoot, but not looking for Bigfoot. Plenty of others are doing that, true believers whose hearts, souls, and wallets are on the line. I am not one of these. Even so, I felt the need to take my research to the hills to confront the concept of Sasquatch on its own ground. I wanted to get inside the head of Grendel, to watch the fleeing forest from within. Most of all, I wanted a perspective only the mountains would give. That's a different goal than that posited in the film, and it is the idea that dominates the book far more than butterflies. Pyle explains why he chose the Dark Divide. Quote, the mountains I chose were Washington's Southern Cascades, a region of intense Bigfoot activity, judging by the density of reports over the years. Specifically, I zeroed in on a range of black peaks running crosswise to the main north-south axis of the Cascade volcanoes. The name Dark Divide applies both to this chain of impressive basaltic extrusions and to the roadless area that surrounds it. The divide, which separates the Cispus and Cowlitz River drainages on the north from the Lewis River on the south, lies roughly in the middle of a diamond formed by Mounts Rainier, Adams, St. Helens, and Hood. Pyle goes into those woods in boots specifically made for him, though as he admits not made for his delicate foot condition. He discusses his past hikes, his preparations, his calculations about his backpack. He plans for his water supply, the days of carefree reliance on clean water in the wild now long past. Every sensible hiker carries a water filter or other means of purifying water sources, he says. He begins the hike after a night spent camping with his wife and makes plans for her to meet him in 10 days for a resupply. He does admit that although walking is one of my primary pleasures, I am not by nature a long-distance trekker, so I should have known better than to think of crossing the Dark Divide to become more intimately acquainted with Bigfoot country and lore. The journey clearly was much more arduous than he'd planned. And along the way, he entertains us with absorbing disquisitions on ghost moths, forestry practices, bears, population biology, remembrances of idiosyncratic colleagues, and much more. As he says, again speaking of Bigfoot, if something we see lies beyond our ordinary experience, do we shrug and say it is nothing at all? This is the central question surrounding Sasquatch. Possessed of soft evidence, most people react with either hopeful credulity or hostile indifference. Only a few ask the hard questions, keep an open mind, then stay tuned for answers that might never come. A few others resort to the supernatural to explain the unexplained, as they always will. For myself, I feel that nature is good enough and rich enough that a supernatural is not required. Therefore, I try to look at the imponderables as things to ponder, certainly not to be dismissed as fantasy, phantasmagoria, or spectral deceits. Does he complain? Sure. He talks about his consternation with Forest Service management methods, especially concerning the use of motorized vehicles on trails. He recounts many small discomforts, and he provides a somewhat humorous list of his hiking ills, about 16 problems in all. However, he concludes dryly, altogether, I felt pretty good. But mostly what occupies Pyle as an abstract idea at the outset and more as a possibly very real phenomenon is Bigfoot. And why? Because as he says, if we manage to hang on to a sizable chunk of Bigfoot habitat, we will at least have a fragment of the greatest green treasure the temperate world has ever known. If we do not, Bigfoot, real or imagined, will vanish, and with its shadow will flee the others who dwell in that world. Looking at that tangled land, one can just about accept that Sasquatch could coexist with towns and loggers and hunters and hikers, all in proportion. But when the topography is finally tamed outright, no one will anymore imagine that giants are abroad on the land. A beautiful way to put it. For my taste, Pyle actually does become a bit too enthusiastic about a search for Bigfoot. It takes over the last third of the book after he has completed his long hike. But you can forgive him a lot because he's a superb writer. Pyle makes you want to explore our vast backyard in so many different ways, via walking, sifting through plant guides, poring over maps, or just reading more of his work. Although he mentions almost all of the episodes the film takes on as singular moments, none of them have the humiliating quality of unpreparedness given off by his filmic counterpart. As for Tae Linnea Pyle, his clearly beloved wife, she's still there at the end of his journey. The book was published, as I said, in 1995. Taya Pyle died in 2013. The film's end credits suggest that the director relied on other Pyle writings as well as the Bigfoot book, and it's certainly possible that some of what happens in the film accords with those accounts. And such conflation is a very ordinary, even necessary part of making a film out of a book. But the book is rich enough without all of these unnecessary dramatic enlargements. Read it instead.
Thank you, Britta. And now let's turn to Jeff Godsell, our Los Angeles correspondent from Essentials of Cinema, with one of his favorites by Blake Edwards.
In 1963, when the original Pink Panther was released, writer-director Blake Edwards was already on a roll. Having graduated from television and the Peter Gunn series, his last two features, Breakfast at Tiffany's and The Days of Wine and Roses, were both hits. The Pink Panther was going to be a light comedy about a jewel thief and a prized gem shot in international locations, rather like an updated To Catch a Thief. And it was. But first came the changes in the cast. Ava Gardner was originally cast in the female lead, but her personal demands were just too much. Janet Leigh was next, but she didn't want to be away from home so long. The production began to take an even more international flavor when Capucine, a French actress, was cast in the lead, and Claudia Cardinale, Italian, was cast as the princess with the title Jewel in her possession. David Niven was always cast as the suspected eventual thief, but the role of his foil, Inspector Clouseau, was originally intended for Peter Ustinov. When Ustinov backed out, the movie gods took over and Peter Sellers stepped in. As shooting commenced, it became obvious that Sellers, with his comic timing and perfect understanding of the Clouseau character, was becoming the star. It is much to Blake Edwards' credit that he not only knew a good thing when he saw it and worked with Sellers on all of his improvs on every take, but he kept the original concept of the Pink Panther from getting lost in the Peter Sellers show. And look how well Capucine holds her own in her scenes with Sellers. Of course, the film became a franchise, with Sellers repeating his role as Clouseau several times, with gradually diminishing returns. And the series finally ended with a double thump with the two Steve Martin vehicles. But the original Pink Panther shows Blake Edwards at, if not his best, certainly at his most representative. Comfortable with romantic comedy, Edwards loved to go physical, too. He was one of the few modern directors who could use slapstick without cheapening everything in the process. He would do it again 15 years later with Dudley Moore and 10. Today, The Pink Panther looks like the perfect film from the early 60s, with its breezy charm and its international look and feel, like Charade or the early Bond films. Blake Edwards had control. His career also had many parallels with that of Billy Wilder. Both had their apprenticeship as writers, Wilder at Paramount in the 40s and Edwards at Columbia in the 50s. Both had successes with dramas as well as comedies. They each made probably the two best films about alcoholism, Wilder with The Lost Weekend and Edwards with Days of Wine and Roses. Both used Jack Lemmon as one of their favorite actors. After big successes, both made indulgent, stupefying disasters. Wilder with Kiss Me Stupid and Edwards with SOB. Both rebounded beautifully, Wilder with The Fortune Cookie and Edwards with Victor Victoria. By the time of The Pink Panther, Edwards already had a close relationship with composer Henry Mancini. Beginning with the Peter Gunn and Mr. Lucky TV series, Mancini scores became closely allied with Blake Edwards' films. They also sold records and spawned singles. Moon River from Breakfast at Tiffany's and the title track from The Days of Wine and Roses. Even that jazzy little tune from The Pink Panther hit the charts. It was the success of film soundtracks like Mancini's that prompted Universal to shell Bernard Herrmann's score for Hitchcock's Torn Curtain thus prompting the famous rift between Herman and Hitch that never was mended. This is Jeff Gonsol for EssentialsOfCinema.com, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, Jeff. And now this.
One of the most important things about KBOO is that it is indeed community produced of, by, and for our community, with the wider listening public kept in mind as well, of course. KBOO is a place where a diverse set of producers volunteer their time to create an outstanding range of material. So whether you've just found out about KBOO or have been a stalwart member for many years, your support is critical. You can donate today at kboo.fm/give. We aren't in the station to take your calls, but you can show your support by giving online. Or you can also mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. And now, back to Film at 11.
Now let's move to Matthew, who's going to tell us a little bit about the latest film that he's viewed.
Well, the movie I want to quickly mention today is a definite classic. It's on the list of one of the 1,000 movies you need to see before you die. It's a movie of great lyrical beauty and nostalgia, yet still filled with optimism of youth and vitality. And it's also one of the funniest movies ever made. And I'm talking about the French film from 1953 by Jacques Tati, Monsieur Hulot's Holiday. Monsieur Hulot is played by Jacques Tati. This is the first time we've seen this character, and he would go on to do 3-4 other movies starring Monsieur Hulot. But this movie is kind of unique. It still has a lot of vitality in it. Unfortunately, Tati suffered a near-fatal automobile accident after this movie and before he made his next movie, Mon Oncle. And the tone is different from Mon Oncle on with the different movies. But this movie is just a great movie about going to the beach and the kids in it, all the things they get up to. And I love movies where kids like sit in the corner quietly and watch what the grown-ups are up to. And there's a lot of that in this movie. There's a lot of visual gags. And even though Tati's character, even Monsieur Hulot, is the center, this is what Tati would call a democratic comedy, where there's lots of interesting characters on the screen besides the principal character, and he begins to develop little gags and stuff that happen in the background and little continuity bits from one character to another. Like I said, there's not much of a plot, but it's like the sort of younger people kind of poking the older people who just want to play cards at night, listen to the radio and read, and then go to bed when the radio goes off the air. And the young people, well, they don't want to do that, of course. And so there's a little bit of that in the movie. But like I say, it's beautifully photographed, and this wonderful little town, which I think is St. Mark's by the Sea, I think is what it translates in the Seine-Rive district. I'm probably getting that totally wrong. And it's an actual town, and Tati statues now stand there on the promenade. So it's on disc from Criterion that you can get it, and that's a Monsieur Hulot's Holiday. And now back to the show.
Now let's turn to the latest book I've read from the British Film Institute's Film Classics series. This one, Sancho Deu, the Mizoguchi movie from the early 50s. In a sense, Sancho the Bailiff is something of a minor character. He is the bailiff or landlord of a work farm in service to a lord, circa 1100. And in this work farm are two of the main characters. Sushio, played as an adult by Yoshiaki Hanayaga, and Anju, his younger sister, played by Kyoko Kagawa. Their mother is Tamaki, and she was the incredibly popular actress, at least in the early 50s, Kenyuyo Tanaka. They end up there after a kidnapping by brigands and sold to the farm, separated from their mother, who ends up being a comfort woman at a nearby isolated island. They were seized while en route to be reunited with the patriarch of the family, a former governor who is exiled to the South due to his liberal rulings, in one case forbidding farmers to be conscripted into the army. Obviously a comment on World War II. This is a sad, almost Shakespearean tale of woe in which the travails of the family, while seeking to be reunited over decades, do from time to time encounter moments of sacrificial kindness from others and even from within the family. Sancho's son, Taro, is presented in parallel to Toshio. He renounces his father's cruelty and disappears from the work farm, while Toshio drifts from his father's humanist preachings, which we hear in a flashback at the beginning of the film, to being reunited with those thoughts later under the influence of his sister. The book has two co-authors, but they are non-contiguous. Ms. Cavanaugh has the first half, while Dudley Andrew has the second. In a two-page preface dropped from the second edition, Ms. Cavanaugh delineates the differences between the two scholars' approach. Quote, Andrew believes that Mizoguchi sublimates a folk tradition into an art film that has participated in the global discourse of cinephiles inhabited by the likes of Jean-Luc Godard and Terrence Malick. Cavanaugh, she continues to write, is less concerned with the exoteric authority of Western discourse than with the timeless attachments of faith and family, passionate bonds at the heart of a story strong enough to withstand a millennium of popular and societal change. End quote. And that's a pretty good summary of their differences. Here's where she gets to the part about why the movie is